Hey, good afternoon, Juno. It's just coming up on 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Pat Moore. I'm hosting Juno Afternoon today, and we have a dense fog advisory through parts of Juno. So if you're driving out there and suddenly you can't see the road in front of you, you might switch on your headlights and slow down a little bit. A locally dense fog is reducing visibility to less than one half of a mile in places. We have highs around 34 and light winds. Today on the show, we've got some folks who are going to come in and tell us about mudrooms coming up on Wednesday evening. Ed Biarski will drop by to tell us about a presentation he's doing Wednesday at noon at the Jack on growing hardy primroses from seeds. And Letitia McCoy will come in from the Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority for our segment on sustainability, and she'll be talking to us about the Energy Sense program, and George Gress will be here from Floyd Dryden Middle School to update us on what's happening at Floyd Dryden. National Native News follows, 5 minutes of that, and then we'll be back with our first guest.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some Ojibwe tribes and the state of Wisconsin head back to federal court this week for more debate on whether tribal members should be able to hunt deer at night. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports that the dispute comes as some say state-tribal relations are at their worst in decades.
A tribal wildlife agency has certified about 75 Chippewa tribal members to go deer hunting at night off the reservation in the ceded territory of northern Wisconsin. The tribe says the state of Wisconsin recently allowed non-tribal members to hunt wolves at night. But the state argues expanding Wisconsin's deer hunt in nighttime hours would be unsafe and is asking a federal court to permanently block the tribal hunters. To Native American journalist Paul DeMain, the dispute is part of a pattern of disagreements between the administration of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and the tribes.
The relationship between the Ojibwe tribes in northern Wisconsin and the tribes in general, from what I can tell, is probably at its lowest stature since the negotiations and discussions between tribes over natural resources began in the 1970s and 80s when a lot of these cases were litigated.
DeMain also cites disputes between the state and tribes over a tribal harvesting of a ceremonial elk and Governor Walker's support for a controversial proposed iron ore mine near the Bad River Reservation. But the governor contends he has a good record of reaching out to Native Americans.
We've had, since I've taken office almost 2 years ago, more than 1,000 consultations and discussions between not just myself and tribal leaders, but each of the various state agencies under our authority as a means of trying to reach out and have better communications between the 11 sovereign nations and the state.
The chairman of the Bad River Chippewa says state and tribal wildlife professionals are getting along well. But Mike Wiggins also told the Wisconsin State Journal that at times the tribes have felt marginalized and forgotten. The chairman of the Lac des Flambeaux Chippewa, Tom Molson, told the newspaper that he blames the Wisconsin legislature for failing to work with the tribes on mining and the wolf hunt. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Native people in Canada rally in opposition of proposed legislation by the federal government. Many people believe the bill is an attack on Aboriginal rights. According to the CBC, hundreds rallied at the Manitoba Legislative Grounds to protest Bill C-45, the government's omnibus budget bill. It has proposed changes to the Indian Act, including land management. The rally pegged Idle No More was sparked by movement online about 4 weeks ago and was carried out Monday. Many First Nations are calling on the federal government to consult with them before proposing changes. New Mexico's 19 pueblos break ground on the renovation of the historic Albuquerque Indian School. The last standing original building of the school will serve as the future home for the Native American Community Academy. The building is on trust land for the 19 pueblos. The nearly $3 million renovation project includes state capital outlay and federal funding. The pueblo's for-profit corporation will lease the space to the Native Academy, a tuition-free public charter school which serves more than 300 middle and high school students. A ceremony was held Monday. On this day in 1830, the last ruler of the Kamehameha dynasty of the Kingdom of Hawaii was born. Kamehameha V became king in 1863. He respected the culture of his ancestors and encouraged the revival of traditional Hawaiian practices. The leader died on the same day of his birth in 1872. He's remembered for restoring power to local chiefs. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM, Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Kiwanis is accepting artwork for the 2013 Alaska Native Art Auction scheduled March 7, 2013. Proceeds benefit KNBA and Native Public Radio programming. Call 907-793-3528 for more information.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're in tune with KTOO News. It's six minutes after 3 o'clock. And Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first two guests are a couple of the ladies who have been, giving of themselves and helping others to give of themselves with a wonderful program called Mudrooms. Amanda's here and Alita. And these are the two ladies, I guess, who organize the Mudrooms presentation. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. We do organize it. And Alita and I also started it. We were on a couch in my house and said, how about this? And,
yeah.
And Alita's like, yeah.
You had been involved in up in Anchorage with a thing which is, I guess, called Arctic Entrances. Right?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. And so the name Mudrooms is
and the Arctic
more
Entries came
them.
From a program in Baltimore. Oh, so
okay.
It certainly was not my idea.
So the format is?
Format is we have a theme every month, and it's a theme that can give someone a parameter and also is ambiguous enough that should they have a particular story they would like to tell, they can make it fit to that particular theme. So we have a theme every month, and then we have 7 people who either Alita and I or members of our storyboard, which include Katie Spielberger, Mark Wheeler, Tom Cosgrove, Rich Moniak, and Pat Race, of course, help us collect. Or people come to us through our website and email address. These are all volunteers. They're not necessarily thespians or performers. They just say, hey, we'd like to be involved. Or they say, yes, fine, after we heckle them. And then they get 7 minutes to speak to that subject. And so there's 7 of those. We have a musician or group of musicians before. And we charge $7 at the door. All of Alita's time, my time, Mark's time, everyone's time that I've mentioned is donated. And 100% of all those profits go to the charity. Right now, we're donating to the Imagination Library. We have treats that people can purchase. Those profits go to the charity as well. And then the event lasts about an hour and a half to 2 hours. And we look for more storytellers the next week. We record it, and then it gets aired on KTOO, KSKA, and Anchorage is the NPR station there. They're also picking us up and airing us in Anchorage. And that's the format. 7 people, 7 minutes, and some music and some treats. And you get to hear a little bit more about the people you live around.
So this all happens at?
We're hosting it at Holy Trinity Sanctuary right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have a few events this season, I guess, until May, that are going to be in the downstairs McPheeters Hall space, but we are in the sanctuary. So for anybody who's really dying to lecture from the pulpit, this might be your occasion to do it.
That sanctuary has really interesting acoustics, so it's it might be a little challenge for some of the speakers.
Yeah, for better or for worse, we kind of worked out some kinks that we had our very first time in the sanctuary. As we started, we had our first event at the Rookery, and then we moved into McPheeters because the Rookery space, we were crowding out quickly. It's been really well received in the community, and lots of people are just ready to come and sit and listen to their friends and neighbors, which is a neat thing. So, yeah, the sanctuary is spacious enough to accommodate a good crowd.
Well, before we opened the mics, I had you counting on your fingers to see how many of these you had done. And my aim in doing that was to ask you a question about whether or not you had sensed any change in what Mudrooms started out to be and what it is now.
I would say our mission remains very concrete, and that is to just allow people a chance to get to know each other more, because we live in a community that's small enough that you might have a small circle of friends and tons of acquaintances, and so there's also people that are on the fringes that you just don't know about, and so it's like a mudroom. You get to see a little bit more of someone, but not the whole piece. And so that mission hasn't changed. Inevitably, other things change beyond our control. And I think that Alita and I would agree that we look at each event as its own being. And there are things that change each time. We had like a rock band once, and then we had this very mellow and mild singer and songwriter that sung. We've had our first husband and wife team got up on stage together at our beginning event in November. And then we've also had people who speak about a death that happened in their family years ago. And we've had someone do a comedy routine. We've had a request from one of the legislators who will be here from Sitka to do a duo with one of his former campaign manager. And so they're just their own beast in a way. And I like it like that. I think that we'll have to make some choices as things go on, such as we decided to allow people to speak once per season. Some people had a really good time sharing their stories last season. And by the way, our season runs October through May. So we're going to have, if people would like to speak again, we'll max it out right now at once per month. Or one returner per month, but you can speak once per season. So things like that have evolved, but I think we kind of determine how we go about things on a case-by-case basis. We definitely have always donated our profits, and this season, I think I made the decision to do it just to one particular charity versus changing throughout the season, and then we'll have a group meeting and discuss who the next charity is. But yes, there's been evolution. We just address it as it comes up, because I think that's part of the appeal, is that every event is different, every person is different, and even if they get up multiple times, they always have something different to share.
But I think it is worth mentioning that Amanda's original vision is intact, and that is to have it be kind of raw and from the heart. And, you know, we discourage people from using notes. They're just really in front of the microphone telling about their life and something that's happened to them in the past. And, you know, we've had people who wanted to, you know, read like a poem, and that's not really the format. And so, you know, the 7 minutes, seven people is something that we're sticking to for that reason.
Have you two been surprised by what has come out?
Oh, it's so fun. It's so fun to, because we don't know necessarily what people are telling about, and the stories just, we are laughing and, you know, crying while we sit on the side with our deer collars waiting to give them waiting to indicate the time. And it's been so fun to see what people come up with.
People ask occasionally via email, is this okay? They pitch a story, and that's great. I love getting a little sentence or two here and there. And on occasion, I've gotten a whole script or so that I've worked with people on. But we don't have any sort of formal rehearsal process. We don't have any weeding process. If you're willing to get out there, we'll take what you have, assuming that you're respectful of other people's feelings, period.
But you named a number of people that you called story consultants. What's their role?
So the storyboard is like our organizational board, and it's a handful of people who are helping us recruit people in the community, helping promote the event, helping do sound, record the sound the night of, and cut
website stuff, which I do mostly. Pat helps out with, and really, Alita and I couldn't do this on our own. So
it's Wednesday night, 7 o'clock.
Tomorrow, 7 o'clock.
Yeah, seven speakers.
Seven speakers.
$7.
$7.
This is so easy. You know, usually I have to go through a whole bunch of different numbers, but you've got it very compactly.
Right, and we're the second Wednesday of the month every other month, and the second Tuesday of the month, the months in between. We found that to be
Yeah.
A working.
Is it the people who have a Tuesday night commitment can?
Correct.
Kind of catch
we usually
the other
get thing, yeah. We average about 130 people in our audience,
mm-hmm.
And that includes, I guess, paying customers. So we don't ask our storytellers to pay, or our musicians, or people helping out. Like we have a photographer. Who takes pictures that we post on our website, too. But about 130 people, and we have capacity for more, and it still feels full with less. So we definitely encourage you to come out. I do want to point out one more thing, and that's it can really be a family event. So I think it's a great place for people who don't who want to get out of the house and go experience something, but they don't necessarily want to hire a babysitter. You can bring the whole family, and it can be date night / entertainment for your children. We're going to have a college student up there, one of our younger people, Ariel Lyon, will be speaking tomorrow night. So we're also looking for high schoolers who are willing to speak, etc. So it's really the event for audience of all ages.
Wednesday night, 7 o'clock at, one more time, the
Holy Trinity
at
Sanctuary.
Holy Trinity
and
Sanctuary.
My mom is one of the speakers
yeah,
tomorrow.
Yeah, outstanding.
Right.
Should be pretty interesting for you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Did you know that Alaska possesses 90% of the estimated potential tidal power in the entire United States? Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to making Alaska a world leader in clean, renewable energy. Find out more on the web at realaska.org. This message brought to you by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
It's 19 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. The Juneau School District Board of Education will be meeting Tuesday, December 11th at 6:15 p.m. in the JDHS Library. If you want more information, please contact the school superintendent's office at 523-1700.
This is Bird Note. Some of the most extensive grasslands on the continent remain in northeast Montana. At this time of year, these lands lie under windblown snow. But by early summer, the grass is verdant, and grassland birds abound. Their sweet songs fill the warm air. Songs such as those of McCowan's longspur, lark bunting, and the willet. Where do these exhilarating singers go in winter? They've all gone south. The sparrow-like McCown's longspurs migrate to West Texas and northern Mexico, where you might flush a winter flock from a grazed pasture or plowed field. Lark buntings, a stocky sort of sparrow, range in winter over much of northern Mexico and the adjacent U.S. They turn up everywhere, from farm fields to desert cactus. Willets, however, seek out truly different winter habitat. Large sandpipers that breed in prairie wetlands, willets spend the cold months along Pacific coastal shorelines, from Washington State south all the way through Central America. For now, winter reigns over Montana's grasslands. June may seem distant, but hearing the bird songs makes you know it's worth the wait. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Minutes after 3 o'clock. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon, and Ed Bajarski just stormed into the studio having gotten caught in the fog out on the roads. We have a fog advisory in effect right now until 4 p.m. this afternoon, and that fog advisory appears to have had its effect on Ed. So, Ed, in the when you get your breath, want me to play a little music?
No, that's okay. But yeah, there was an accident. Nothing serious, but somebody out in the median out there...
So you're about to do a workshop tomorrow at noon, right?
Yes, at the Jack at noon, free to the public. The Master Gardeners have been doing this once a month, October, November, and December. So this is the last one for now, and then hopefully in the spring we'll start up also. Doing these little workshops on hopefully stuff of interest to local folks, gardeners. I'll be talking about starting from seed, primroses, hardy primroses, stuff that grows here, and blue poppies that lots of folks would like to grow. Some of them are available as plants from local nurseries. Some of them are really only available through the American Primrose Society or getting them from some place from someone who has a plant or has multiple plants that sets seeds. And some of the primroses, some of the most beautiful ones that we already have around here are only available. You can't start them from seed. You have to get divisions from them. Somebody has to share them with you. And same thing with the blue poppies, and there's other colors of poppies too, the Mechanopsis Asian, some of these Asian poppies that do so well in our cool, moist climate.
So what's the time constraint here? When do you have to have these started in order to be able to
have
beautiful
I guess the important thing is getting the seeds first. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the American Primrose Society, and I can give you the website for that, they have a seed exchange for their members that folks order seeds now, starting soon anyway in December. And then normally we start our seeds in the winter. I start some of mine usually in February. And the basics of it are start out with some clean potting soil from fresh stuff from the store. Don't reuse stuff or use garden soil. But then I'll sprinkle the seeds on top of the soil Sometimes I'll sprinkle a little bit of sand on top or vermiculite or perlite, and then I put them outside for a month or so. And what that does, again, in February, March, that helps the freezing, thawing action that we normally get that time of year, helps to break the dormancy of the seeds, and then I'll bring them inside, put them underneath good old fluorescent shop lights. You know, they're pretty cheap at local businesses and stuff, close, a couple inches away from the light. And a lot of these seeds, and it really varies with variety how quickly they sprout, but some of them, you'll see sprouts in a week or two, where some of them may have, if you didn't do that cold treatment, a few might sprout, but a lot of times some of those seeds will stay dormant, and they'll go through, if you were to save those pots that you put the seeds in, they wouldn't germinate till the following year. And usually by that time around here, we get moss and other stuff growing on these pots. I mean, that's been my experience. And the seeds have a hard time pushing their way through the moss and algae that have grown on them in the meantime.
I'm wondering, Ed, are there other seeds, like seeds that you would plant in your garden that need this same cold freeze and thaw treatment?
Well, again, with a lot of, I mean, the stuff that is our native plants around here. If folks were collecting wild seeds, for example, wild iris are a really good example, or the shooting stars that grow on the wetlands around here, they're actually a primrose relative, and they benefit very much by that sort of treatment. Mm. Again, thinking about how things happen, normally seeds are ripe, you know, finish ripening and fall to the ground in late summer to fall. If folks are out skiing, cross-country skiing on some of these meadows, they may actually see these seed pods of the, I've actually collected seeds from the shooting stars in December and January, because they're sticking up above the snow. I'll be skiing along. I mean, literally, I'll have a little plastic bag and just take the seed pods, put them in the plastic bag. Same thing with the wild iris. And that's nature's way. And then the seeds, the wind blows them around, so they get kind of spread around a bit. And then they go through the through this freeze-thaw cycle over the winter. And again, some of these seeds will also stay dormant in the ground, because if it's a thick meadow already, they don't get to the soil. There's moss and other stuff growing there. So until there's some disturbance on the wetlands, that could be something like a flood, or even the, if you something like that works, is if there's man-made disturbance, disturbing the soil, I mean, even to something like people skiing across over some, say, muddy ground, or dogs and people hiking across the muddy ground in the springtime, that that opens up the soil enough that this stuff can sprout.
Ed, every time you open your mouth, I start taking notes. It's amazing the catalog of knowledge that you've accumulated over the years gardening.
Well, thanks. I've certainly been doing it a long time. I've professionally killed a whole lot of plants. I've gotten, talking about some of these seeds, I've gotten seeds from all over. They have come from all over the world. And some of them have grown exceptionally well for us here in Juneau. I mean, Juneau was officially declared the primrose capital of Alaska by our beloved city fathers and mothers a few years back. Mm. So we are really fortunate. The cool, moist climate that we have is similar enough to a lot of Europe, a lot of alpine plants from Europe, Southeast Asia, up in the Himalayas, up to 10, 12, 14,000 feet, which is where some of these primroses that we grow here are native to. And the blue poppies are native to that area in the Himalayas also. And folks want to grow them in Chicago, can't do it. It's too hot and too dry in the summertime. They just wilt. You know, the Pacific Northwest is really a great place for growing these plants.
So here's a chance to learn how to start these things from seeds, if you can get a hold of the seeds.
Right. Well, I'll actually have some seeds of stuff I've collected myself. And again, it's AmericanPrimroseSociety.org is the website. So folks can go to that. There are links there to see lots of beautiful pictures. I'll be showing some slides of some of our locally favorite plants tomorrow. Again, at the Jack, noon. Bring a bag, brown bag lunch, and we'll chat about growing.
And learn about primroses and blue poppies. Thank you so much. I'm glad you made it in past the accident, and we had a chance to talk about it.
You're very welcome.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 11th of December, 2012. It's the birthday of Grace Paley, born New York City in 1922, grew up in the Bronx, surrounded by all sorts of immigrants. Her own parents spoke Yiddish and Russian at home, English only in public. She loved to hear all these different tongues. But when she started writing poetry, she wrote in a formal, stilted British style. She thought that's what poems were supposed to sound like. And then she met W.H. Auden, and he read her work. And Grace Paley recalled, "We went through a few poems, and he kept asking me, 'Do you really talk like that?' And I kept saying, 'Oh, well, sometimes.' That was the great thing I learned from Auden, that you'd better talk your own language." It's the birthday of the novelist Jim Harrison, born Grayling, Michigan, 1937. Big reader as a kid, but very religious. And then he said, up to 16, I wanted to be a preacher. And then one day I did a whirlwind. I jumped from Jesus to John Keats in 3 days. Started out as a poet. And then in 1970, he was hunting. He hurt his back, had to stay in bed for months. And his friend Thomas McGuain told him he should try writing a novel. So he did. It was entitled Wolf, A False Memoir. And a few years later, Legends of the Fall, his first big success. Published 2 books last year, The Great Leader, a novel, and a book of poems, Songs of Unreason. And it's also the birthday of the man who prompted Harrison to write that novel, Thomas McGuain, born in Wyandotte, Michigan, 1939. His first novel, The Sporting Club, 1969. His 10th novel came out last year, Driving on the Rim. Thomas McGuain, the only member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, who is also in the National Cutting Horse Association's Hall of Fame. But he says he doesn't consider himself a real rancher. All the ranchers I know have had back surgery, operations on their rotator cuffs. They all have new knees. I'd like to think I belong to that breed, but I don't. And it's the anniversary of UNICEF, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, founded on this date in 1946, to provide food, clothing, and medical aid for children in countries devastated by World War II. Here's a poem for today by Stuart Kestenbaum, In Praise of Hands. It's not just the people who live in the city who've lost the thread that ties them to the woven world of stones and earth, fields alive with pollen and wings. Who among us understands how oceans rise and fall, currents swirling around the planet with messages in bottles floating on the water? When the tide is out, we can go to the shore, dig clay with our bare hands, and make something beautiful from it, a vessel with thin walls that holds a canyon. In both hands, like an offering, we can hold the memory of eroded stones and earth, eons contained in this empty bowl. We can fill it with water that reflects the sky that has witnessed everything since time began. We can drink and be blessed, clouds gathering over us. In Praise of Hands by Stuart Kestenbaum, from Prayers and Run-On Sentences, published by Deerbrook Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, a service for managing businesses' online image by working to improve how they look in search engines and review sites, Reputation.com. And by Allianz. Allianz has been providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the United States since 1896. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, produced by Nick Vedder. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 25 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Well, that's the music that sort of signals that we're going to talk for a few minutes about sustainability, an issue in Juneau. And we have a special guest on the show with us today who is in charge of a program that is working through the Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority called the Energy Sense Program. Latasha McCoy will be joining us shortly. Well, hi, Latasha.
Hi, Pat. How are you doing?
Pretty good. So tell me about the program that you're in charge of.
Well,
as I understand it, it started out as one program, and it was called Energy Sense, which is spelled C-E-N-T-S, mm-hmm. but now it's like energy quarters or maybe energy half dollars or bucks or something.
It's really blown up to when we first started the program, which is great. I mean, we started with the vision of just providing energy efficiency education to Southeast communities and hiring locally in Southeast communities, and from there it just completely grown to something that we're very proud of. We just got done doing a calendar contest for K through 12 students, and that should be coming out this December. And we're currently doing 400 home energy assessments right now, and our energy assessors are doing a great job with that.
Now, is this how is this tied to the energy assessment program that I underwent, where I had a fellow come and he did an energy audit on my house, and then from that I received some loan money to pay back once I'd done the improvements? Is that the same program?
This is actually, it's very complementary to that program. This one's more focused on behavioral modifications and energy efficiency small upgrades, helping the homeowner understand their utilities bills, helping the homeowner understand how they can save energy in their home, just one-on-one education with the actual homeowner is what we're focused on, more conservation tips and small upgrades. So what you had was probably more extensive upgrades than...
Yeah, it was in the tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're about 300.
Yeah. Well, that was the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, I think, program is what I came under.
Yeah.
And several of my friends have gone through the same process and are going through the same process.
Oh, yeah. I've heard a lot of great things about that program. I mean, we're just absolutely trying to be complimentary of their programs and also the weatherization program, just focused more so on individual behavior modifications and help supporting with energy efficiency tips for households. I mean, a lot of people, especially in the rural communities, are already conserving quite a bit. So if we can help with any other education that they might not be aware of, that's kind of our goal with this program.
Well, Latasha, you're not just in Juneau. You're scattered all throughout the Southeast.
Right? I've been doing the Southeast tour, which has been absolutely fabulous. I'm getting used to little plane life, I guess we can say.
Little planes and hairy landings and takeoffs.
Yes, yeah. Juneau's my favorite to try and get in and out of, but it's been great. We just got done going to... Gosh, what was our December? I think it was Huna. We've been to Huna, Saxman, POW, did a Juneau fair.
Angoon, I think, was the first part of
December. I think Angoon's coming up January 18th.
Oh, okay.
We're going to combine that one with their science fair, which is great. With our program, we also like to try and get the youth involved because they're the best educators, our youth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're working with the Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority.
Yes.
Do you work on houses that aren't part of that program? So you're
Our focus is low income and elderly households. So we do have NAHASDA recipients, and those are low income household qualified. We also have LIHEAP recipients that are qualified for this program. Throughout the 14 communities, we have some homes that are within our housing stock, some that have been conveyed, and we also are going to have an application process for some people that didn't want to partake in the program. We'll definitely open it up to the communities, and that's by request. I mean, if we could do whole communities, that would be our ultimate goal, but we need to get money to be able to do that. So,
do you have a sense of how much energy savings you've accomplished or the programs are accomplishing?
I don't have an exact dollar amount. We are currently collecting the data to try and figure that out. We've been collecting 12 months prior to this program, so from September 2011 till September 2012, and now we're collecting data from September 2012 to 2013. We're going to see a year's worth of savings and see how much we save. But we have a bunch of testimonials of people that are like, I've switched into energy smart plug strips and I've been saving this amount, or I have programmable thermostats, or, you know, those small little changes that have affected their bills, and they get to witness it, which is great.
One of the things that came out, I know you probably don't know where this program came from, but we began this by doing a kind of a man on the street interview deal over in the Jack. At when they had their last farmers market of the year. And as one of the things that came out of the people that we talked about, because our question to them was, how do you see sustainability for Juno? How does Juno sustain itself? Was that there was a fellow who said that the government can't do this. Mm-hmm. It has to be done by the community.
Yes.
And that it's the people, really. Mm-hmm. It comes down to each of us doing this, because it's not like you can do a government mandate that causes people to turn off their light switches or to buy more, you can help them buy more efficient appliances and that sort of thing, but you can't mandate it. You can't control it. So it really comes to the community.
Oh, yeah.
How much of that, and you're saying, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Can you talk to how that's going on in the communities that you're working in?
Yeah, of course. Well, right now, a prime example would be Cake Alaska. They started with an energy fair, I think, in 2009. And from there, they gained a little bit of interest as a community in trying to find sustainable solutions for energy. And now they have a bunch of other funding that's been coming to the community, a bunch of other bigger organizations that want to help support their communities. And right now, we're just trying to help Southeast communities be sustainable, especially our rural communities. And I think that overall, our rural communities are passionate about where they're from. My family's all from Angoon, Alaska, so, you know, their energy cost is about 275% above the national average. And they want to be able to stay there.
Yeah. It's absolutely shocking how much Alaskan villages pay for fuel.
Yeah.
Really shocking. Numbers that we can't even imagine,
Yeah.
So,
and with that, the first phase of our program, we're really focused on getting data throughout all the 400 homes we're going into to make sure that we can identify specific needs within each household so we can try and get more funding for these communities to make sure they're sustainable. That's our biggest goal, is to collect data and try and get any kind of support we can for the communities, especially the high-cost communities that we've been going to.
Is there, I'm wondering if you can answer a question that has been to form as a result of the interviews I've been doing, and that's this. In its worst sense, I guess, are these villages sustainable? In other words, is there a circumstance that you can see from the work that you're doing that would cause us to have to ask people to move?
Well, I do think that there is out-migration in our rural communities just because of the fact that there's such high costs in our communities. But overall, what I've been noticing is that there are a lot of survivors in our communities, too. I mean, they work very hard to conserve, and they work very hard to make sure that they can maintain their current lifestyles. Subsistence is huge, so if we can even find freezers that are more efficient or refrigerators that are more efficient, because in those communities that subsist, there's two or three freezers and refrigerators. Even if we can help with that cost and that bill, I think they're going to try and stick it out and make it work.
And I guess then the second part of that is, and I don't know if you feel comfortable with the question or not, but not only how to sustain, but how do we thrive? That's really the core of what I'm thinking about. Having heard a lot of wonderful things from a lot of wonderful people that I've interviewed in this series, there's an undercurrent of pride and kind of, I don't know, I want to say Yankee ingenuity or something like that. It has to do with being very proud of having taken a step and doing something. I did 5 shows on composting, and the people that I interviewed said, gave me a feeling of such pride in the fact that they were cycling, the things that would go into the landfill if they didn't do this.
Yeah.
You know, and I wonder if you find that in the people that,
oh,
that
yeah.
you work with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's backed by people that call into us and they say, thank you for helping me learn how to reduce our energy bill. If you have anything else or if you'd like to come back for a second energy fair to teach us on how we can do renewable energy solutions or heating energy solutions. And that all comes down to education, I think. Educating on options that are helpful, educating on energy efficiency supplies, just, you know, making people aware of what's out there and what grants are even out there is you know, what's going to help out our communities, I think. And also just we as a housing authority and us as an Energy Sense program need to work on trying to find those solutions too.
Latasha, how do people come in contact with you?
You mean the clients that we're working
yeah.
with?
Yeah.
We actually, what we did was we looked through this enormous database through LIHEAP, NAHASDA, you know, housing clients, and we selected low-income and elderly households, and also households that are currently paying their utilities bills and households that are currently in high-cost communities.
I guess my question goes to if someone feels that they are not that they would like to have mm-hmm. the service from you, how would they contact you? How would they get into the program or find out if they're eligible?
They would call me at Clinton Hyde Housing Authority.
Okay.
And 907-780-6868.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for filling us in on this aspect of energy
thank
and sustainability
you.
In general.
Thank you for having me.
So we'll continue our series on sustainability over the next next week, and then we'll take a little Christmas and New Year's break, and in January we'll be back with another aspect of the sustainability picture for Juneau, Alaska.
Support is provided by USPS Contract Station, offering postal services downtown on the corner of Franklin and Front Street, with extended hours from December 10th to the 22nd, Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 5:30, and 9 to 3 on Saturday.
Short of 10 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is got drafted. My next guest is George Gress. He teaches at Floyd Ryden Middle School, and we were to interview Principal Milliron today, but unfortunately he was called away to a meeting, and so I imagine the scene went something like, George, what are you doing this afternoon?
Quite a lot like that, yes.
Yeah. So, George, what do you teach?
I've got an interesting program. The reason Tom asked us to come is one of the most exciting things we have going on at Dryden, as well as maybe in the whole district, is something called the Blended Learning Pilot Program, which is kind of a mouthful. But the idea is it's kind of the first time this has ever been tried in a mixed public school classroom in the world. And it's a combination of online learning and teacher expertise. So we've got 57 sixth graders, Sandy Palke and I. She and I are both long-time experienced teachers, and we wanted to be involved with this because it just seemed like a chance to try something new with kids that might just work.
George, is this related to this thing I've been hearing about that has the funny name, I can't remember, multiple user education deal, whatever it is?
That sounds right to me.
Yeah, I can't remember what they call them, but there's a name that's applied. And I have a friend at Juno, or at UAS, who is teaching a course in mathematics for educators through this process, and they have students from all over the world.
I think that's one of the things that appealed to us, too, is that wherever one of our kids goes, one of our students right now visiting family in Pakistan, and he's keeping up with his lessons because he can do. Any place that there's an internet connection, he can keep up with his lessons.
And stay in touch with his fellow classmates as well.
Yes, he can.
What a wonderful age we live in.
Well, there's a lot of good things about it. I'm really surprised and pleased with not only getting to know these 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds, but to see how they grasp this right away and are willing to work diligently to just to make the best of it. It's different from any other classroom they've been in. Each kid has a laptop and comes in the morning and works 45 minutes at a time, but we try to cover all four academic subjects in the morning and shortly after lunch. They still have their regular reading program. They still go to their regular exploratory classes in the afternoon and play violins and sing and cook things. So they have a kind of a normal experience outside of ours. But for us, it's very different in the classroom. Lots of collaboration. Sandy and I have become, instead of what we used to call the sage on the stage, standing up and lecturing, we've become the guide on the side. So the joy of this piece is when we talked about how we might help our classroom experience be better, what we noticed is the really bright kids would get their work done, and then they'd just be kind of idling or looking for something else to do. Sometimes that was good, and sometimes it wasn't.
I had a son in that category. I'm right there with you in the principal's office a lot, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, well, we would have loved to have your son in this program. And conversely, some of the learners who take a lot longer to learn, they were frustrated because I would say, well, that's the lesson. We've got to move on. Well, now I don't need to. This is completely individually paced, and the kids pretty much choose how long they want to stay on a topic and work on it, and then they can switch to something else.
Let me get a better sense of the detail here. A student is sitting in front of a laptop, and what is he or she doing?
Well, the lessons, the online curriculum that we bought, if you just sit down and try to do the lesson, it looks pretty much like it would look in a regular classroom. There's a vocabulary lesson followed by direct instruction, which is a video from an instructor that's hired to do this from the online curriculum company. And then that's followed by practice, and that's followed by a quiz. Now, if a kid really wants to buckle down, that'll take 45 minutes or an hour, and that subject done with English for the day, does another one done with math for the day. But we do have some kids who – I've got one student who is really focused, and he said, I only want to do one subject at a time. He's now finished the sixth grade language arts year. Mm-hmm. Now, he doesn't have any math done yet.
Right. So it's going to be a scramble for the math.
Right, yeah. But he feels like he's more in charge of his learning.
So you can focus like that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I'm wondering is, I'm going back to my son.
Sure.
Who had a terrible time with language arts,
mm-hmm.
but who was a mathematical whiz. So rather than letting one of them completely go, could he go as fast as he wanted to go through the math and slower through the English at
Absolutely.
The same time?
Yeah. Now, because
because we have other things to consider too. We really are trying to make them as well-rounded as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, what we would try to notice with your son is if he's struggling with language arts, then Sandy and I might notice that several other kids in the same category. We pull them off for a small group lesson. Everybody else is still working, no harm done. They pick up what they need, their deficits, and come right back into the classroom. Conversely, your son, who may have been a whiz at math or something, can go to us and get enrichment, can go further, faster, and farther abroad.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess my next question is, the instructor who's doing the lecture on the video, do you feel the students relate to that person in a way that's at least analogous to the way they relate to the in-person, in-class person?
Well, not as well as they would do. I mean, I'm egotistically involved in this, so, of course, none of those lectures do a good job as I would.
But, of course not.
No.
Foolish of me to ask.
Of course, no. And we have noticed that the quality of this program is pretty good. The World History program, the kids are always complaining about it, and I've complained to the company about it, but most of the time, it's good quality stuff. They don't, because those instructors are talking to a camera, they'll tell jokes that fall flat because no one's laughing, you know. So, but it's workable. It's workable. And the nice thing about the lectures is the kids can pause, go back, take notes, listen to that again and again, where they might not be able to if I were lecturing.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess I've heard that the comparison between the educational worth of something that you get online and something that you get in person, that they don't compare. And I'm wondering what you're finding, and particularly I'm wondering, how are you going to test? How are you going to know that this experiment is producing students that are as well educated as they would be if they had spent time in a traditional, traditional classroom?
And my own children, too, have experienced some online learning, and they thought, well, there were some weaknesses with that. So we think that's the joy of calling it the blended learning, is that they have Sandy and me. They have us to back it up, to enrich, to clarify. Mm-hmm. So we think we can come up with a pretty good overall experience. The testing, of course, Mr. Milliron and Glenn Gilbrick, our superintendent, are of course concerned with the numbers. And so because of the MAPS testing, the SBA testing, and our reading tests that we run at the accelerated reader program that we use, all of those give us sort of standardized data that we can look at.
And then does the school have like a resident statistician or someone? Is there someone who's going to be able to do the interpretation of these results and help you with those kinds of analyses?
We think so. Sandy and I don't think that's going to be a burden for us, but Mr. Milliron is a data expert, so we're going to let him put in the hours to do that.
Yeah, okay. But pass it off to the principal,
right?
George, this is a fascinating glimpse of something which is really revolutionary. I guess my final question would be, do you think this is going to spread? Do you think we'll see more of this kind of education?
Well, I think we will.
Will you become the guy on the side instead of the sage?
Whether we're entirely successful here or not, which I think we will be, I think this is what's going to happen for lots of reasons. But I guess that if I have one last thing to say, it is that I'm having more fun than I have for a long time, and I love to see these kids work together. They just they'll just spontaneously bring in cakes to share with the crew, and they'll get up and help each other if they need to. It's a wonderful community that we're building.
Well, your enthusiasm just comes popping right through. So I hope it is as successful and as enriching for the children as it obviously is for you.
We'll let you know.
Let's go out with a little music. Thank you very much, George Gress from Floyd Dryden Middle School, talking about this new program. on tomorrow's show, Andy Klein will be the host. He's going to be coming, talking with Jim Clark about the World Affairs Council Speaker Jack Perkowski, who's coming to town. Sarah Asper-Smith will be here. She's highlighting a new children's book. Photographer Doug Jones will talk about his Wildlife Wednesday presentation and the weekly update on Eagle Crest. You're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. We transmit on 104.FM in downtown Juneau, but we're also on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can hear us on K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears our signal at 88.1 on K201 AM. K220BT serves Hoonah, that's on 91.9 megahertz. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210AS at 89.9. And you can also see us or hear us on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871 with our sister stations on 872 and 873.